Hello, bursting chests and sinister wax dummies and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
Our guest today is a senior columnist for the Daily Dead website, where he writes horror news and reviews, and he is also the author of the new book, A Cut Below, a celebration of B-horror movies, 1950s to 1980s, a delightful compendium of essays about the great and some not-so-great titles from the golden age of genre cinema. Friends, say hello to Scott Drebit. Hey, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you for taking the time to come on. Let's start with the uncut plugging. Let's sell the thing. Tell the folks about the book, A Cut Below, how it's organized, which I think is really kind of ingenious.
You know, ever since I started writing for Daily Dead back in 2015, I wanted to do a horror column that focused on, older horror movies. And so, and they were the only folks who would, even respond to me, and I called everyone, and they said, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's do a weekly column on just some movies I think that, you know, that deserve some love for the next generation of folks that are getting into horror. So we started driving dust-offs in 2015, always with the intention that I wanted to make a book someday of whatever you want to call it, a reference book, a review book, a guide, just something in that vein, because it's what I grew up with. I grew up reading the Eberts and the Leonard Maltin guides. And yep. As far as horror goes, the John McCarty splatter movie stuff, Chaz Balloon, the whole nine yards, right? So sure. I was just ready to go as far as diving into doing a horror book. The way I put this together was I put it into festivals. There's 12 festivals, and I wanted to make them festivals just to keep the theme of a celebratory nature, which is in the subtitle of the book. I wanted to keep it upbeat, and I wanted to really make it a celebration. So I thought, well, let's do some different configurations and give people some ideas for their own Dusk to Dawn, you know, drive-in show if they want to do. So I just thought it would be fun to group it into subcategories or festivals, running a gamut of topics that I find near and dear in B-horror movie lover's hearts.
So, you know, we don't want to give them all away, you know, want to save some for the reader, but what are some, just a couple of the festivals and sort of the organizing principles of them?
Well, the very first one right off the block is the Animal Killdom.
Right.
And that starts off with Willard, its sequel, Ben, Grizzly, Kingdom of the Spiders, and Piranha.
The When Animals Attack movies.
Yes, it's the When Animals Attack festival. And those are just so damn fun. I thought this should start off the festivities, as it were.
Wait, are you trying to be an author or a programmer?
Because I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, say as the meme goes, why not both? Yeah,
because somebody should hire you right now.
If the lotto ticket comes floating down,
there you go.
Yeah, we'll open a repertory house for sure. So, you know, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hand. That's for zombies.
That's one of my favorites. Yes,
I like that one. Any portmanteau in a storm? We cover. Anthologies, which I absolutely love and were a core of my childhood horror viewing. You know, that's just some of the various categories. I think it's a good cross-section of decades and subgenres, you know. Yes. And what I like about that was kind of a side effect for me after putting the festivals together, was seeing what effect those films had as in a vacuum by themselves and how they sure. played culturally. You know, some were from almost the exact same time. Some were a little earlier. And it's interesting to see how different cultural aspects affect and are played out in horror movies through every decade, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I will also add, and again, I don't want to spoil all of them because the table of contents alone is such a pleasure to read. But I will say, I think my favorite one might be Festival 7, which is the one of sort of Canadian tax shelter horror movies, which is titled... which you have titled Back Bacon Bloodbath, which is like, mwah, perfecto. I am curious about the selection process for this, like, you know, because you had a lot of choices here and clearly a deep bench of knowledge about these movies in this period. And I know you said a lot of these began as sort of part of the column, but what sort of determined, you know, what was going in the book and what was going to sort of work well together?
I honestly just thought of, I came up with the categories first and then, you know, went through my writings and found ones that would fit well with that, as well as new ones that would also fit well in that I just haven't gotten around to writing about. So it's, again, you know, it really, some of it is kind of like a happy accident. Like I said, until I put some of these together, I didn't realize sometimes thematically what was there, you know, and it's kind of fun even for me now to go back and look and say, oh, okay, there is a lot going on thematically with these movies, but nothing too, you know, nothing too heavy. Hey, I mean, I put Who Can Kill a Child in with, you know, Those Darn Kids.
So there we go.
You know, there's your socio-political stuff there.
All right. Well, you unsurprisingly chose a year to talk about with us from the period covered in this book. What year did you choose for us and why?
I chose 1979. Okay. And the reason I chose 1979 is, and the movies that I chose, is because for me, I was 9 years old at the time. And
there you go.
And this was right before, for my family, the birth of the video player. In 1980, from 79, in 1980, we moved overseas to Jamaica. My dad was with the bank and they had transferred him overseas. There wasn't anything to do but watch movies as the TV station, the one channel came on at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. So we went down with one of the top loader dishwasher Panasonic.
There we go.
Right. And we bought some tapes. I remember we spent, I think, $300 just on videotapes. And there was three of them. One was
right.
Our first tapes were Friday the 13th.
There you go.
That was my pick. My dad's pick was A Clockwork Orange, and my mom's pick was Norma Rae, just for some balance.
There we go.
So
there we go.
The timing of us moving and the advent of this new technology meant it was a complete game changer, because now it was, you could watch, if you were a movie lover, and even at the age of 9, 10, I was going to the movies a lot as a kid and by myself, because I was in a small town and there really wasn't any harm in that, as they say, or I lucked out. But there was so much great content, even at that age, that by the time I got around to getting a video machine, there was already so many movies that I was already looking forward to, and five of those movies happened to come out in 1979.
All right. Well, that's, you teed up that, that's a nice tease. Well done, sir. We're going to get into those five, which are all bangers. Before we do, we're going to find out what was going on in the world outside of the neighborhood video store. Here's Mike with headlines.
1979 got off to a busy start. The Pol Pot era in Cambodia came to an end, and the Shah got booted from Iran. Good stuff. Fuck those guys. Yeah, then the Ayatollah Khomeini and Margaret Thatcher came to power. So, like, let's not get too excited about the revolutionary change of 1979. Part of that whole Khomeini thing included militants taking over the U.S. embassy in Tehran and taking hostages. This was arguably the biggest news story of the year in the United States, and it had a huge impact on the presidential election in 1980. You know what I recently learned?
What's that?
The Reagan campaign asked them to not release the hostages until he came to power because he was it was polling well for him.
Correct. Yes.
Is that new information? I didn't. I feel like I should have learned that before I did.
It's been knocking around for a little while. You know what else? You know how I know about this? There's a little picture called Argo, my friend, and highly recommended about the hostages in Tehran.
It was a dramatic enough situation that, it was a dramatic situation. You can make a movie out of it. I was going to make a joke about Ben Affleck needing to surround himself with drama in order to make sense as a human being, but that was unnecessary. I'll probably cut it.
Correct.
Several hundred people were killed in the Soviet Union when a bioweapons facility accidentally released anthrax spores in Sverdlovsk.
Accidentally.
Seems like a good reason to stop making those.
Oopsie doodle. Look what we accidentally released. Yeah.
1979 saw the introduction of the one child policy in China.
All right.
A thing which is, I think, as we are singularly unqualified to comment on, but seems very hard to enforce, in my opinion. I don't know.
I was thinking, you know, in 1979, I was watching The Incredible Hulk. The Dukes of Hazzard. That's what I was doing.
There you go.
I wasn't freeing any hostages, that's for sure.
Nor were you accidentally releasing any anthrax spores. So, you know,
not
good and bad.
Exactly.
In other Incredible Hulk news, we had a little teensy tiny bit of an almost meltdown at Three Mile Island.
Right.
It was not good, but it could have been much worse. It could have poisoned Lou Ferrigno. 1979 was the year of the Greensboro Massacre in North Carolina. This was the first time the American Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan started working together in partnership. And in their very first event, they shot and killed five anti-fascists and injured several more. In the various trials that followed, they were all acquitted on self-defense. But later we found out they had planned to shoot all along, and the Greensboro police knew about it. The protest was originally called the Death to the Klan March, so I guess that was enough of a threat to justify, no. The Greensboro City Council has apologized several times in the years since, but you know, sorry doesn't bring light back to the broken bulb, right? Everything but art is awful. Thank God for art in 1979. The 1979 saw the release of Off the Wall, still Michael Jackson's best record, and every time we do a show about 1979, I'm going to fucking say that.
Highly recommend Spike Lee's Off the Wall documentary. Well worth tracking down as well.
Fab, absolutely. And finally, Charles Mingus died in 1979, and Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang was released. And if I was writing a book about 1979, I would make a really big deal out of that now obvious popular genre border. But this is a movie podcast, so we're not going to do that. That's headlines.
Thank you, Mike. Scott Drebbit, you ready to do a top five?
Let's go.
All right, we decided that we're going to do we're going to try a little Russian roulette top five here. We have not decided on the order. I'm just going to call it out, and Scott's going to pick the next one, and we are going to go from there. So, Scott, what is the first film on your top five for 1979?
Let us dig right in with Ridley Scott's Alien.
Great movie.
In space, no one can hear you scream. Alien, rated R from 20th Century Fox.
A classic for a reason.
a classic for a reason. Again, a movie in 1979 that I only knew through trailers and quick cut trailers on TV and at the theater. And I didn't get to see it actually until a couple years later. It showed up on the in the Jamaican circuit. So I did get to see it on the big screen, but I did see it on video first before we saw it in the theater on the big screen.
So what was your first impression, like the first time you saw this this really kind of brilliant mashup of horror and science fiction?
Absolutely. I thought it did its job incredibly well. Again, by the time I saw it, I think I was probably 10 or 11, but it it really got me with its suspense. I never even saw it as a science fiction movie. I just bought into it as, you know, there it's a transport and they happen to be in space.
Yeah, and, it's a haunted house movie.
Yeah, it's a haunted house movie. It's the creature from outer space, literally.
Right.
But I thought it was so well done. And no matter how many times I go back to it, you can really just marvel at how well put together it is. It is, you could use a stopwatch with it to time. That suspense couldn't be timed any better. The music, the performances, it's a beautiful movie, but it's absolutely horrifying because I can think of few things more terrifying to me than being caught in a space where you have no escape. I was never one that was terrified of the whole birthing and how men are terrified of birth, etc.
Right.
I think I was a little young on the bell curve to even, you know, smoke my pipe on that one kind of thing. So, but as a adolescent seeing it, completely thrilling and an instant classic. And I remember having the videotape and that started the replay of watching it over and over. And I think I watched the Blu-ray of the first movie just last month again. You know, it's eternal.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. The thing that's sort of really fascinating for me to think about this movie in context, because it has become such a classic. It has had so many sequels and it has sort of traversed, you know, so many decades, is, you know, to go back to a conversation we've been having all season, Mike, about 70s movies and the working class hero. And what's, I think, so great about Alien that you don't pick up on the first couple times you watch it, even, is that this is a working class space movie.
It's the same thing you said about The Abyss. Like, James Cameron loves making movies about film crews, and like, they're not making movies in any of his movies, but it's all dudes from his film crews. And this is a crew movie.
It is. It is. And, you know, the contrast between what Star Wars is 2 years earlier, both in terms of the aesthetic of the thing, that, you know, that all of the spaceships and, you know, all of the interiors are so sort of clean and pristine and sleek. And the fact that this is a ship that this crew fucking lives on and works on, and it feels lived in.
They're smoking
in space.
Space. Who else smokes in space?
But that also, like, you know, a big chunk of the first act is like, you know, Harry Dean Stanton and Yaphet Kotto is like, you know, the sort of the grunts of the crew complaining about the work that they're having to do, and like almost threatening like a strike if they have to do this extra shit. Like, it is an extremely working class outer space movie to an extent that I don't think a lot of other pictures have tried.
Yeah, the first half is like a Paul Schrader, you know.
Yes. It's like blue then, collar in space, yeah, complete with the avocado in space,
and then bad shit starts to happen.
Right, exactly.
You know, but it pulls off the illusion, because anytime you sit back from Alien, especially when it gets in the back half and we get to see the alien more and more, and again, you know, he plays it masterfully where we're just getting teases here and there until the end when he has no choice to do it. So you take a step back from that, and it, you know, it's just as silly on one level as any other haunted house or giant monster in the rubber suit movie. It really is. It's all about how it's put across, right? And that front half where they establish the characters is key.
Yeah. And the fact that he had so many A-plus actors that it's like, it's not just, you know, it's not randoms. It's not even like character actors, really. It's even like Sigourney Weaver, Tom Skerritt, John Hurt, Ian Holm, the aforementioned Yaphet Kotto, Harry Dean Stanton. Like, these are not slouches. These are like honest to God actors, and none of them are playing this like they're slumming it, which I think is really key.
You know, it's essential, right? It's the only, otherwise it doesn't work if it, otherwise they're playing it as a comedy. And these were all people, you know, other than even the British actors, who were all kind of on the same trajectory in Hollywood, coming up in that 70s and doing the bit parts and coming up, and they would all end up getting their due, as it were, on screen, either slightly before this, and many of them, or all of them, after, you know. And this thing made hand over fist money because it works so well.
Not that Alien needed to add to its legacy in the internet age, but let's not forget that Alien is also the spawn of like an all-time classic meme, right? The mm-hmm. shot of Ridley with the cat that says Alien is a movie where nobody listens to the smart woman, and then they all die except for the smart woman and her cat, 4 stars. Yeah, I mean, that's an all-time meme culture classic, right?
Yes.
Alien, still giving in the internet age.
I love it.
All right, Scott, let's spin the wheel.
All right, who's next? Well, you know what? Let's take a trip to Canada, shall we?
Okay, let's do. And
let's visit David Cronenberg's The Brood.
You are about to journey beyond fear, beyond terror, in a major motion picture so frightening, it will devastate you totally. The Brood, David Cronenberg's ultimate experience in inner terror. They're waiting for you. The Brood, rated R.
Beautiful. Released, I found out, May 25th, the exact same day as Alien. Like, these hit the theaters the same fucking weekend. So you could have had a hell of a double feature in late Memorial Day weekend of 79.
This 9-year-old would be reading Starlog and crying. I'm never going to be able to see these. Well, that's not true. There was, I mean, the year before, I went with my parents to see The Deer Hunter. So,
oh, wow.
Tomato.
Anything could happen.
You know, anything could happen, right? But it didn't. And that's what, again, all of these are the ones that come time for video age. They were the ones that I was like needing to see immediately. The Brood is no different. The Brood is it's simply one of my favorite Cronenbergs because while it does have that, up to that point, that familial body horror that he was dealing with, he also, as the common story goes, he was going through a divorce at the time, and this film was reflecting, kind of very much reflecting a lot of different emotions going on through him, let's be fair.
Through the prism of a sicko, yes. But yes, through, it's a divorce movie. Yes.
Through the prism of Cronenberg's, Coke bottle glasses.
Yes.
Very much so. But it's, there's a human element to it that I found he was starting to embrace, and he was starting to kind of thaw out to human relations, it seemed, because his early work is really chilly. There's no denying Shivers is a stone cold movie. Same with Rabbit. There's not a lot of emotion. This is him thawing out a bit. I don't think he has a choice because of what he's dealing with. It's clearly a very personal movie, but I also think it's his most traditionally scary movie. The way it's set up and the way it's played out, we're given beats that are more familiar with suspense movies than Cronenberg just saying, you know, look at here, look at this wild thing or something, or going for the gross out. He's going for some suspense here and some beats that he hadn't, that for me, I thought he hadn't introduced before. And I thought it was, it really just kind of lifted the movie into exciting territory for him that he would certainly open up even more down the road with, you know, the Dead Zone and The Fly, which is like one of the most romantic movies of all time. You know, so he had really opened up, you know, by that point. But The Brood is kind of like the start of him kind of like thawing out a little bit. And plus it has Oliver Reed, who's you know, one of my all time favorite actors. So it automatically gets an extra star just for that.
Well, and I mean, and I think that's actually really significant that, you know, as much as, and I do, I love Shivers, I love Rabbit. They're great fucking low budget genre movies. This is the first time that he's really working with like kind of actors of real note and skill and, you know, who have resumes before the movie. And so I think you really, you know, he, for all of the time we spend talking about him as a stylist, you know, and as an aesthete, he is, I think, an underrated actor's director. I think he coaxes really interesting performances out of a lot of really noteworthy actors. And what he's doing with Oliver Reed in this movie is, I mean, cuckoo bananas, but it works. It's really, it's a really compelling performance.
Yeah. It's like 100%. He's just funneled Oliver Reed and then regurgitated it back to kind of, the nth degree, seeing Oliver Reed, in like just a little tiny robe, which is like way up above his knees, kind of emasculates him. It's very funny. It's, I should say, the Oliver Reed performance has a lot of intentional, I think, not necessarily a humorous, but he's very much on his toes and he's very much present with the material, and I find he ends up being a sympathetic character towards the end of the movie, and that's to his credit, I think, 100%.
Yeah, I will also say I fully enjoyed like the public rehabilitation of this movie, which was really poorly reviewed when it came out. It was one of Siskel and Ebert's dogs of the week, if memory serves. And now, you know what? Fuck off. It's in the Criterion Collection, baby. It's right there on the shelf. God bless it. Scott, what then is the third movie on your top five for 1979?
Let's go. Another first time director with David Schmoller's Tourist Trap.
Tourist Trap. Beautiful young people looking for excitement are tricked, terrorized.
Get this glasses! Let go!
And trapped. God help those who get caught in the tourist trap.
This is not happening!
Rated PG.
Ooh, this one, I will tell you, was my only first time watch on your list. One that I'd always kind of meant to get around to and had not. And it is really something, Scott. It is kind of way out there.
It is. It 100% is. From Pino Donaggio's absolutely bizarre and memorable music with all hitting the wooden blocks, and it just works beautifully somehow. Chuck Connors, you know, that horror icon, Chuck Connors, the Rifleman himself, gives a really good performance. He wanted to be a horror icon, and he was hoping that this movie was going to make him, you know, another, he loved guys like Vincent Price and Boris Karloff, and then he wanted to be like that. Well, Tourist Trap did not do as well as Alien, the other movie on our list here. But it's low budget virtues. It's a great looking film, shot on film. It has ton of atmosphere. It doesn't make a lick of sense. And that's used to its advantage by just the casting alone of Chuck Connors, the super freaky production design and set design by Robert Burns from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which raises this to through the roof.
Yeah.
The mannequins in this movie are just cuckoo bananas creepy. It's one of those movies that if I had seen it in 79, like at the drive-in on the bottom bill with who knows what else, I would have been freaked the hell out. I have no doubt. And would have just totally dug it as it was when I saw it the following year, but it wasn't a magnet releasing. It was a media.
There you go.
Media put that out. And again, I watched the hell out of that one because it just had this amazing box. And I think I'd read about it in Famous Monsters.
There you go.
Possibly.
That's the endorsement you're looking for. Now, this is a movie that I had heard quite a bit about for years because this is one of the most notorious PG ratings of the era. Like, this is a movie that wildly... was not rated R. This was rated PG by the Motion Picture Association of America. Scott, why do you think that is? How do you think it got away with that?
There are so many 70s movies. Really, if people want to look, if you're looking for, I only say subversive because a movie that gets labeled PG, there are a lot of movies in the 70s that got stamped with PG that had no business being anywhere near a PG.
You mention a few in the book. Yeah.
Many, you know, Grizzly has a horse head flying through the air and an arm flying through the air. PG, sure. Bring the whole family.
Yeah. Sure.
There's a million examples from the 70s. They were looking at, oh boy, sex, it's the same old story. Sex gets you an R.
Right.
Boobies get you an R, right?
Right.
Horse heads flying gets you PG.
There's 20 different points in this movie where you're like, oh, like some boobs are about to come out. You're not even like sort of like waiting for it. It's just obviously this is the point in the 1979 horror movie where there's going to be some boobs.
Right.
And then there's never any boobs and you just sort of... You wouldn't really notice in any given scene, but over the length of this whole movie, you're sort of like, that seems weird. That seems like a weird choice. But it makes sense when it's like, that's it. That's the whole thing. You can have psycho mannequin murderers, but no boobs, no nips, you know?
Yep.
And like,
yep.
Beautiful ladies in clothes that would be easy to pop a boob out through the whole movie. And no boobs pop out. So, like, it's because at some point it's so obviously a conscious choice that it does actually become a question.
Yeah, that is very true. It is, I will also say, though, you know, not much in the way of gore. It is more of an accent on suspense and really, truly, as you mentioned, on atmosphere. I wasn't aware of that Chainsaw Massacre connection, but that totally makes sense. It's very much that same vibe, but not quite without that R-rated intensity. Although Toby Hooper, I remember reading, was somehow going for a PG when he initially made Chainsaw Massacre as well, which also has no nudity. So I guess
it all makes which sense. Has no nudity, right?
I guess it all makes sense.
Chainsaw is the same thing. That's one of those movies that feels more violent. And I think, again, with some of these horror movies, they would go with the tone, you know, regardless of what the content was so much, right? So Texas Chainsaw, well, what is shown in Texas Chainsaw, right?
Right. Yeah.
That movie is like more intense than just about anything out there. So, you know, some filmmakers in the 70s use that to their advantage. Some would just simply skirt any issue they had, and they would like submit a false print to the MPAA.
Right.
right? And then they would get it back saying, yeah, that's fine. And then they would insert back in the stuff that they were, right, that they never had any intention of cutting at all. Right. So
love that. It's a hustle, man. It's all a hustle. All right, Scott, what is the fourth movie on your 1979 top five?
We are going to go to one that is featured in If You're Happy and You Know It, Clap Your Hand.
Yay.
Which is Zombie 2, a.k.a. Zombie, from Lucio Fulci.
You are in a room filled with your friends, but they're all dead. Suddenly, one by one, they begin to move, to live again.
What the hell are they?
Zombie.
How can we stop
them? Take this.
Zombie. They are decaying. They are missing from their graves.
Shoot him!
Zombie. It's shocking. That's why no one under 17 will be admitted.
Save me.
All right. So for listeners who got confused by your title summary there, how is this movie both Zombie and Zombie 2?
So George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead was known as Zombie with no E on the end. In Italy. So therefore, when it came time for Lucio Fulci to get on the zombie bandwagon, because Dawn of the Dead was a huge success, he decided to call it Zombie 2, because this is what they did. They would find a property, they would find an IP, and they weren't called that back then, but they'd find an IP, and they would just slap an initial on the end and say it was the next installment of this movie.
This ran rampant, yeah, in Italy, from what I have read, which is part of why there's like literally 100 Django movies.
There you go. There's five of, I think there's five zombies. I could be wrong. There may be more. There's a lot of houses too.
I think this is the third Lucio Fulci movie I've seen, and this is by far the most respectable of the Fulci movies that I've seen.
Which tells you about the other two.
And that's including a shark POV upskirt. I really enjoyed this movie. You're like, holy shit, there's a shark, so now he's working on Jaws. You know, okay, right on. And then all of a sudden, the fucking shark is fighting a fucking zombie? Fuck yeah, let's go. This was some sort of a weird crossover between the Fulci I know and respectable movies that I didn't think was necessarily going to work, but it really did work.
There are some great set pieces in this movie. Like, I think it overall really works, but there are individual moments in this movie, which I saw for the first time, I don't know, like 3 or 4 years ago when it first came out on 4K. I think about the thing with the nail in the eyeball, I don't know, once a week.
I find it, yeah, you're right. It is a movie of set pieces. You could talk about the plot. It's certainly the most linear of that later period Fulci films. Having said that, yeah, the set pieces, I think, when it gets to the stuff on the island, I think, is very evocative, even in daytime. But that whole street, when they show the streets filled with these zombies walking down, it really does take you back to, which is, again, was part of his initial inspiration, right, was the old zombie movies, right, from the 40s, and mixing that with Romero's is what he was going for. And it works. I think it works beautifully once it gets out on the water and starts to get to the island. The New York stuff is where the respectable ship should sink very quickly.
Yes. Yes.
With Lucio as the editor with his pipe. Yeah. But yeah, it's beautifully shot. The score is one of my all-time favorites. So this one I saw probably before and just before I saw Night of the Living Dead. I hadn't seen Dawn.
Oh, wow. Yet. Okay.
Night of the Living Dead, again, was another media release on video. So, but Zombie came out through Wizard, and they came out about the same time.
That famous box cover. Oh my God.
Yeah. We will eat you. Right.
Yeah.
I had to pick the, as like a 10-year-old, I had to pick that one first.
Of course.
So Zombie, AKA Zombie 2, would really be my first zombie movie that I saw. And it absolutely like terrified me, like for real terrified me, because, and for the longest time, I found Italian horror really downbeat and grim. But again, that's maybe because I was like some little morose teenager or something. And it's like, I watch them now and I'm like, no, kid, it was just you. You're maybe a little sad and or horny, whatever the case may be. But, you know, no, they're full of what I love about European horror, you know, Japanese horror. They somehow manage with the same budgets we have to be so much more endlessly creative overall in their effects, in their storylines. Like they go for it and then they find a way to tell it.
They find the shark POV upskirt.
They find the shark POV upskirt. You know, the films in this book obviously, you know, work different. They get a very limited budget and they're just doing the best that they can with what they got. And of course, results may vary as they do.
Yeah.
But yes. Zombie Zombie to this day, still, I think, is just absolutely a perfect zombie film once they set sail.
There we go. All right. Well, that brings us to the conclusion, the fifth film on the 1979 top five. Scott, what's it going to be?
The fifth film, and I saved it for last just because I think it's the most important to me, and that's Don Coscarelli's Phantasm.
There have been many terrifying films, but there has never been anything quite like this. It could be the most shocking experience of your life. Phantasm.
And why is it the most important to you?
It is the most important because when I moved to Jamaica, it was one of the first movies that I got when we got to Jamaica. There was a company on the coast that would get in new tapes and they would sell copies, right? Where pirating was very Hell common yes. in the day. You had a catalog and you're like, yeah, yep. We'll take this one, this one, this one. Phantasm, I knew from seeing a trailer for it on the CBS late night movie on TV, and knew nothing else of it other than seeing like a 30-second trailer. And then I think reading in the newspaper, wherever it was from, it gave it like 1 star or something. So away I was super intrigued. Yes. And then seeing the trailer made me even more intrigued. And the title alone just was like on my tongue forever. I just thought it was the best title ever. So then we moved down there in 1980. And, you know, other than watching movies, it's hard making new friends in a new community, in a new country. So I, you know, I took a lot of solace in movies, and when I did get around to seeing Phantasm, it really resonated with me because I was more or less about the same age as Mike. His brothers moved away, his parents are away, one brother's dead, another one's leaving town, so right. You know, it played in perfectly to kind of this the feelings that I was feeling, this homesick feelings for Canada. It kind of dovetailed perfectly with it. And the Tall Man, right from that point, became my absolute idol for for horror villains because he felt like my own personal villain because I was Mike, you know? So Phantasm is, it's so crazy. Like I have a Phantasm tattoo. That's what I'm saying.
Wow. It's okay. Life. I love the idea of this like super intense, super violent horror movie being like your tender coming of age drama. I love that.
Yeah. Well, it's so character based.
Yeah, it's true.
It's also very though, like, cause I watch a lot of these with my wife and like, you know, my wife doesn't know about your letterbox, might not even know that that's a thing. Like does not give a fuck about anybody's opinion. And so I'm watching The Brood and she's like, this is not my favorite decade. And I just start laughing. And I was like, you know, that's not how a lot of other people feel. And she's like, I know, but everything's so fucking precious.
Uh-huh.
Right. And like, we're watching The Brood and okay. She's got a point, you know, like, you know, and then I was like, all right, then motherfucker, you want to act like that? Let's throw on Phantasm and cut off The Brood at about 25 minutes and put on Phantasm and was like, all right, here you go. Then you want to talk about fucking precious. Wait till the flying lobotomy machine comes out. Like here you want a movie. She loved it anyway.
Good.
Right on.
What a great movie, dude. I mean, like it has all of those things, but it's also just such a fucking perfect, crazy, late 70s, exciting, awesome horror movie. Like,
yeah,
you know, there's lots to be said for a thriller, but like, this is a fucking horror movie, dude. This, you know, not slasher, but using a lot of the slasher techniques, I guess.
Yeah, that back half, that moves like a fucking locomotive, man. Like once the sort of all the pieces are in place, Coscarelli just goes, you know, in a really engaging way.
And again, you know, if that lotto ticket comes floating down from heaven and lands in my pocket, I have to have a 70 Hemi Cuda, you know, and I'm not a car guy whatsoever. And it won't be standard. It'll be automatic.
Yeah.
But I have to have it.
Fair. Certainly worth picking up. All right, Scott, thank you so much for that choice top five. Now let's find out about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year of 1979. Here's Mike with the Hollywood Minute. Hollywood freaks from
the Hollywood scene. The biggest movie of 1979, if you can believe it, was Robert Benton's divorce drama, Kramer versus Kramer, starring Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep, which was both the highest grossing movie of the year, $106 million, but also won the Oscars for, God damn, let me get a sip of water. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay to Mr. Benton, Best Actor to Hoffman, and Best Supporting Actress to Streep. And if you wonder if a movie like that could be next year's box office champ today, just reflect that Marriage Story basically went straight to Netflix. Fuck.
Scott, thoughts on Kramer versus Kramer?
She's terrible. And I'm not, you know, just siding with the dad cause dad, she's a terrible, character, but it's an amazing performance. I mean, I think that was like the first movie, probably saw it in like a hotel room when they had the boxes on and you could pay probably even then $12 and have it added to your hotel room. I'm sure I saw it, then. I know it was the first movie I definitely saw her in. It is a very good movie. It's very, speaking of precious, it's very dour. It's very downbeat, but incredibly well made.
A few other movies managed to win Oscars that year, however, including Norma Rae, previously mentioned, which nabbed Sally Field her first Oscar for Best Actress, but this was not the You Really Like Me year. Being There, for which Melvin Douglas won Best Supporting Actor, and Breaking Away, which got Steve Tesich a Golden Boy for Best Original Screenplay.
Some good pictures
precious,
in there, yeah, Scott?
Precious.
I saw Breaking Away in the theater. A great movie. I absolutely love Breaking Away. Dennis Christopher is just a joy. Paul Dooley as his dad. It's great.
Perfect,
and it has, and it has, you know, it's a great underdog story. I think it pairs nicely with something like Rocky, you know? It's got a lot of heart.
The second highest grossing movie of the year was, in fact, a horror movie. the Amityville Horror, to be precise, launching one of the oddest and most prolific franchises in all of cinema.
Scott, where do you land on the old Amityville Horror?
I saw this in the theater, and I actually, my first horror book that I read was before the movie came out. I read Jay Anson's The Amityville Horror. That was my first.
Oh, wow.
That was the first horror book, grown-up horror book that I read, and it scared the piss out of me. The movie did not so much. Even by 9, I was like, this isn't scary to anyone. Little Jody the pig in the attic. The scariest thing was probably James Brolin's perm, I think, was probably the scariest. The scariest thing. You know what? It's a better movie than its reputation says, but it still ain't good. The second one I find incredibly entertaining, and should be like separate from the Amityville franchise. But Amityville, too, The Possession with Burt, the late great Burt Young, is where Amityville should have started and stopped.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, we should mention to people who aren't sort of well-versed in just the chintziest of bargain basement horror that similar to our previous conversation about Zombie and Django, Amityville, because it's the name of a city, correct me if I'm wrong here, Scott, is not like sort of a copyrightable title. So there are just scores of odd haunted house and haunted object and haunted space movies that are all like Amityville, yada yada. Like there's just a ton of unrelated Amityville movies.
They can't copyright the name Amityville. So I think one of the latest ones was Amityville Outhouse. There was Amityville Karen. there are some brave, talented souls out there who have gone through all of them that have the word Amityville in the title. And I salute them too.
But no, life is too fucking short.
I'll tell you what, though, when you're a kid and not in full possession of your cynical logic, that book is scary as hell.
the book scared the hell out of me. Absolutely.
Other big commercial hits of 79 included Rocky II, Apocalypse Now, Star Trek, the motion picture, and Scott's beloved Alien. In March, Buena Vista Distribution, best known for putting out all of the Disney movies, released Takedown, their first PG-rated motion picture. It was not an original Disney production, but it was still a significant shift for the then-struggling Disney brand. That is such a hilarious collection of words, struggling Disney brand. Another one came in September when Don Bluth led a group of Disney animators to resign from the Mouse House, unhappy with the direction the company was taking, and struck out on their own. Their first feature, The Secret of Nim, shout out Secret of Nim, would come 3 years later, and Don Bluth Productions would present a serious threat to Disney throughout the 80s until the so-called Disney Renaissance began with The Little Mermaid in 1989. And I assume they had Don Bluth killed. I'm just going to assume. In October, producers Benjamin Melnicker and Michael E. Uslan acquired the film rights for Batman from DC Comics. The Superman the movie had been a huge hit in 1978. It would take a full decade for the Batman movie to finally make it to the screen. And here they went through a lot of tests, nipple tests on the, the chest.
Much later, Mike. That was later.
My fault. Lost a couple of icons in 79. Mary Pickford, one of the first honest-to-God movie stars. And John Wayne, one of the biggest. Also leaving us in 79, the great directors Jean Renoir, Dorothy Arzner, Nicholas Ray, and Ernest B. Schoedsack. Great actress Jean Seberg and Joan Blondell, the great film composer Dmitri Tiomkin, and the fourth and last surviving Marx brother, Zeppo!
Yay!
Oh, the best went last, eh?
Indeed.
And making their first appearances in 1979 were Barry Jenkins, Natasha Lyonne, Rosario Dawson, Zhang Ziyi, Oscar Isaac, Jennifer Love Hewitt, Lee Pace, Lake Bell, Claire Danes, Kate Hudson, James McAvoy, Maggie Q, Chris Pratt, Mindy Kaling. It's interesting how you don't know these people are all the same age because they got famous at different times.
Right, exactly.
Busy Phillips, Kevin Hart, Jason Momoa, Evangeline Lilly, Aaron Paul, Tiffany Haddish, Sarah, I never know how to say her last name.
Bareilles.
Borellus. That either the E or the I is extraneous. You got to just pick one, right? Sarah Borellus, Diego Luna, Jordan Peele, and his Get Out co-star Lil Rel Howery, and Aaliyah and Heath Ledger, both gone too soon. That's your Hollywood Minute.
Thank you, Mike. All right, Scott Drebbit, you ready to do a lightning round?
Let's do it.
All right, you know how it works. I'm going to feed you a list of titles pulled from John Willis's Screen World Film Annual for 1979. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. And here we go. Blake Edwards, 10.
Loved it. Because I was 10 and Bo Derek was naked.
Carl Reiner's The Jerk.
The Jerk I also saw in the theater, and that's when I first found out who Steve Martin was and absolutely was killing myself laughing, even at 9, because a lot of that humor, stupid, registered. Still does. Still stupid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Speaking of stupid, James Bond in Moonraker.
Moonraker, again, saw in the theater. Roger Moore is... Kate, here's your hot take for the day. Roger Moore is my favorite James Bond. Yeah.
Oh!
I said he was my favorite.
Spoken like a true 70s kid. Yeah. No. Spoken like a 70s kid.
Yeah, he was from 73 to 85, you know. He was our guy. So, Moonraker, a great silly fun. And it doesn't lean too heavily it didn't go as Star Wars as much as it could have.
The Muppet Movie.
The Muppet Movie saw in the theater was one of my favorite movies that year. Absolutely loved it. My friends and I came out singing and laughing after the movie. For this 9-year-old, it was like the perfect film going experience. I can still picture me and my friends sitting there watching it.
This one's a little bit of a technicality, but it was mentioned before, and it was released internationally in 78, but 79 was the U.S. release for Dawn of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead, again, I wouldn't see Dawn until probably 82 or 83 when Thorn EMI put out a clamshell on it, I want to say. I could be wrong, but I think that's when I finally got around to seeing Dawn, but it's classic. It's classic. It's great.
When a Stranger Calls,
saw that in the theater. The first 20 minutes are brilliant, and then gather up the kids and warm up the station wagon because you're not missing much after that.
John Badham's Dracula.
Never saw that in the theater, but I did see it in one of those fabled hotel rooms for the $18. I liked it. Again, I wasn't familiar with Dracula at that time, but it was a good movie. I liked it. It moved well. I thought he was a good Dracula, had a lot of atmosphere. Yeah.
Good double feature. Werner Herzog's Nosferatu the Vampire.
There you go. I have not seen that version to this day, but the original Murnau is one of my all-time favorite films.
Abel Ferrara's Driller Killer.
Wow. Again, you know, that wasn't double billing at any drive-in near me.
Sure.
Or near anyone, probably. Sure. I didn't see that till early 90s, I saw Driller Killer, and I thought it was fine.
Giulio Paradisi's The Visitor.
The Visitor is, again, I didn't see till much later. Again, thank you for the advent of home video and these boutique labels that bring back movies like this. I wasn't even aware of The Visitor, certainly at the time. Until much later on. Anytime you can get Franco Nero playing Jesus with John Huston as God and yes. Lance Henriksen as, if I'm getting this right, the messenger of the devil whose daughter
right.
is going to be the second coming of... It's it's one of those that has every actor who was clamoring to be in a horror movie at the time and looking for some nice cheap Italian sun got to make this movie that maybe the reels are out of order. Maybe they're not. I don't know. It's a mystery.
But, correct.
But it's very entertaining.
Prophecy.
Prophecy, you know, what's really funny is one of my best friends growing up, their family was like uber religious and they never, they wouldn't get to see like usually a lot of the movies that I would go and see because of their parents. But somehow they roped their parents into taking them to the drive-in and they saw the Prophecy. And the thing I remember most about the movie, well, it's just the one scene really. And that's the kid hopping along in his sleeping bag, and the monster swats him and he goes flying into a tree and the feathers fly up. It's a great massacre. Anytime I can see kids, obnoxious kids get killed in a horror movie, I'm all for it.
I'm a happy man.
I'm a happy man. It's fake, folks. So that, but what I remember was my friend next day at school acting out the scene, hopping along with a sleeping bag on, telling me what this was like. So I never saw it until, again, the next year when it came out on video. And I thought outside of that scene and the okay-looking pizza bear, there's not a lot going on there.
Silent Scream.
Silent Scream had this incredible 30-second trailer of a girl climbing up to an attic and she puts her hand through like a hole in the wall and someone reaches in and like grabs her. Had nothing to do. It wasn't footage from the film or anything.
Oh, wow.
That's all I remember from the movie.
And finally, Love at First Bite.
Love at First Bite, I do believe I saw at the drive-in in 79. No, again, that was another hotel pick. I remember distinctly.
There we go.
And unfortunately, the home video version, they didn't get the rights to I Love the Nightlife by Gloria Gaynor, and they had to use song for when they're dancing around.
Oh, a travesty.
When he's seducing her. Yeah, it totally deflates the scene entirely.
See, I know this one from early days of HBO, like that early HBO era when they only had about 12 movies. Sure. They wore out Love at First Bite, and that had been licensed for television. So I associate that song with that picture very strongly, and that is a crime against cinema. All right, Scott, you did excellent on the lightning round. Where can people follow you on social media?
You can find me at the strip mall at Phantasm 2. That I meant X when I said that. I'm also over on Blue Sky more than not. S Drebit, just punch that in. You can find me there. Same thing, my real name over on the Insta, and I'm trying out the book talk TikTok. It makes me scared, fellas. I'm not going to lie.
Sure.
It's a whole new world.
We're too old to be learning new technology. The book again is A Cut Below, a celebration of B horror movies, 1950s and 1980s, and it gets the old a very good year seal of approval. This is a terrific, informative, fun book. Congrats on writing it. Congrats on its publication, Scott. I am Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show, including this one. Mike, where can people find you?
Brainwashed Lib on Twitter, Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And as usual, we again plead that if you like the show and you think others might like it too, you know, we appreciate you sharing it on social. We appreciate all of those boosts. It also really helps if you leave us a rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice to lift us out of the literal metric ton of other movie podcasts out there. Mike, before we go, what is your parting recommendation for 1979?
Man, I was going to say Rockers before we started talking all this shit about watching movies in Jamaica, and now it just seems like the most appropriate possible response. I smoked a lot of weed in the 90s in a lot of college towns across this great country of ours.
Yes, yeah.
And every time, no matter where you went or across the country, the people with the best weed were always watching Rockers. I don't know how to explain it. They were almost always white. It's not like they had Jamaican connections. But there was something about what was called Kind Bud in the 90s. And and having a VHS copy of Rockers that just really seemed to go together. It's a great movie. They're speaking English. There's English words. But the patois is so heavy that almost every version I've ever seen has been subtitled. You know, sort of similar to like the Les Blank, you know, Deep Bayou movies, where it's like, I know some of those words, but that's not a language I speak, you know. And what I really like, I don't think I've ever used the phrase, it's a vibe, before in my entire life. I feel like I'm too old for new phrases, but this motherfucking movie is a vibe. You know, it's Jamaica. It's like, you know, it's heavy Rastafari and these guys. And apparently it started out as a documentary. But it's definitely not. There's a few scenes in the movie where he's just sort of walking around. There's a scene in a recording studio where they are actually recording what ended up being a very famous song. But I think they just sort of dropped those elements in, because most of it doesn't feel at all like a documentary, but it does feel like they went to the real places where the shit was happening to go make their little movie. I just love it so much. And it's also, there is all of those things, and all of those things are real and true. There's also only like basically one female character, and she's just his naggy wife who's terrible through the whole thing. There's also there's four total white people in the whole movie. Two of them have one line each complaining that the reggae band isn't playing Calypso. And the other two are trying to rip off a locksmith. So like, it's not a big movie on diversity, but yeah. It's one of those movies where you're watching it and you think it's just a vibe. And then all of a sudden, 45 minutes into the movie, a fucking plot boils up out of seemingly nowhere. But it isn't actually out of nowhere. They've been doing it the whole time. You just didn't know it. And then once the plot settles in, there's a couple of points after that point where you're like, did they forget there was a plot? But then no, they did not forget. That's just how fucking Rockers works. And every time you think that it's not going to go somewhere, they bring it back. And the end of this movie is just so fucking satisfying. Anyway, I love it, dude. I love it. And I've watched it many times smoking Kind Bud on couches in Lawrence, Kansas. But I have also watched it later as a more informed movie fanatic and adult. Holds up, dude. Rockers. It's the most 1979-esque movie ever. But I imagine, especially if you lived in Jamaica. I love that movie. How about you, Bailey?
I'm going to go with Going in Style, from writer-director Martin Brest, who would go on to do Beverly Hills Cop and Midnight Run. And then, you know, Geely. I really need to reiterate that there is a 2017 remake directed by Zach Braff, starring Morgan Freeman and Michael Caine and Alan Arkin, and it's really terrible. And if you've seen that and think that this must be like that, it's not. Like, that movie feels like 2017 in a really specific and gross way, and this movie feels like 1979 in a really specific and great way. The plot is irresistible. It's George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg as three old retirees whose lives are they're just kind of waiting around to die. And so George Burns comes up with the idea of, hey, why don't we go rob a bank? It'd give us something to do. It'd be interesting. Best case scenario, we make off with a lot of money. Worst case scenario, we go to jail and our Social Security checks accumulate, and then we have a lot of money when we get out. And so it's a heist movie, but it's a heist movie as character drama with these three terrific actors, really just living and owning these roles to their bones. And I will tell you that the closing moment of this movie is a very close second for me to Pelham 1-2-3 as my favorite last beat in a 1970s movie. Going in Style, track it down, check it out. It's really quite wonderful. All right. Thank you again, Scott.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. This was terrific fun.
Really appreciate that. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
Sweet and clear. It was a very